Welcome to Changing Currents, Climate Conversations in South Yorkshire. In this series, we explore climate perspectives and possible futures with local communities, bringing different practices into conversation around local environmental issues. By focusing on actions and connections, we intend to give a sense of how working on a local scale can create positive social and environmental change. For this episode, we are situated in Barnsley at Wisborough Mill and will focus on themes of remediation, resourcefulness and ecological health.
I'm Simon Dodd. I am the miller and site manager at Wisborough Mill. My job entails producing flour on a traditional water mill using water to drive stones to produce wholemeal flour, which we then process into other flours for sale.
I'm Safa. I'm an 18-year-old sixth form student who's also a climate activist. I've been involved with Barnsley Youth Council, Regional Youth Climate Assembly, working locally, regionally, nationally to better our environment.
I'm Hayley Ewell. I'm the coordinator at the Culture, Health and Wellbeing Alliance, and we're a free-to-join membership sector support organisation for creative health in England. And our mission is to build a common understanding that creativity and culture are integral to health and wellbeing, and we really want to convene spaces for more intersectional creative thinking about how we can collectively face the multiple health inequalities and ecological crises we all face.
My name is Sean Roy Parker. I'm an artist, writer and gardener. I live in Derbyshire and most of my work is about reconnecting our body with place and seeing ourselves as neighbours with non-human communities.
We've moved across the courtyard to the mill. And I'd like to hand over to Simon, who's going to talk to us a little bit more about the history of the mill on this site.
So there's been a mill in Wisborough itself, as for most villages around since the Domesday Book, but this particular mill dates from 1625. It's split into two parts. We have the old mill, and then we have the new mill, which was built in 1840. And although flour has not been milled continually here since 1625, it's been a fairly consistent producer of flour. In terms of places to be and to visit and to work, it's something a bit special.
We're in this kind of long and wide and very short room with lots of ancient wooden beams of different ages, and there's some heavy metal equipment and lots of bits and pieces to the side that may or may not still be in use. There's a, above the fireplace, there are loads of sort of incisions or drawings where former stewards and millers have engraved their names or initials or particular dates. And it kind of feels like we're in the stomach of the mill, the bit where all the digestion happens. Digestion is a shift of state, a dissolving of borders, a surrender of deep minerality. But digestion is also the period of change, intrinsically tied to a beyond human sundial. Wild and domesticated yeasts fly around in search of food, not meaning, suspended in symbiosis between invisible life forces and blunt human tools of perception. What is dust? Why does it collect around the bottom of a chair and get stuck in a shard of afternoon light? Who puts it there? Who keeps it up in the air? Decommodification is the reincarnation of dead objects.
So with that, we'd like to start with the first question. How can we see the mill as a site of cultural and environmental remediation?
Well, maybe first of all, we can try and define remediation. And there's two main definitions. So one is to correct or put right, and one is to resolve or improve. And I feel like they push in slightly different directions. The idea of correcting something is the idea of going backwards, yet the idea of improving something is moving forwards. And I think there's a really interesting push and pull there, particularly in the idea of, as we move through time, and how can we add new layers onto the existing layers of history?
The mill has over time evolved. You know, originally in the 17th century, it was just the old mill, a two-storey building with the miller and his family living in part of it, screened off from the flour production. And people would bring their grain by cart, have it milled, and then take most of it away, leaving some as payment. And then as Industrial Revolution hit, 1840s roughly, the new mill was built. Three-storey, steam-powered mill, greater production, trying to feed the people who are moving into the area. And now in the 21st century, we're at a point where a lot of those traditional skills and crafts have kind of waned, and we're trying to keep them back up, so we're trying to improve them. On site, we've got plans of how we can move into the 21st century, just in terms of power. If you look just at the story of power, you've got water power to steam power. 21st century, hopefully, self-generated electrical power. That's where we'd like to go. Time will tell.
So, Safa, have you got any kind of ideas or responses to that, thinking about the place where we are today in the mill, perhaps your own relationship with the place?
As someone who's lived in the area my whole life, I've always known of the mill. And when you're little, you look at it and it's such an old place. When you're young, you're just like, oh, that is old. It's all you've ever known. You can't think that far back. And that is the first experience I had with it. It's an old place that used to make things. And as you grow up, you learn more about the details of what they actually used to make. How old actually is it? What are the developments that have happened to it? How has it improved, or how has it reverted back to what it used to be? So it's definitely a historical place that means a lot to the area, and that is really important. And I think it shows how you can improve, but you can also take a step back that isn't necessarily going backwards in the negative way. It's actually going backwards to do something better. But I think you can use the mill as an analogy to lots of things in life and how we can improve. I like that use.
So learning from the past, bringing that forward.
The challenge really is to connect people with the land through a historical lens. So building a sense of place and kind of keeping these pre-automatized processes happening. And, you know, I mentioned that it felt like we were in a stomach, or kind of the area of digestion, and even just people coming in and being able to see the processes that are now very much removed and very, very far away from how our food is produced. So for me, there's like a radical acceptance of the imperfect past and a kind of a promise of a more intentional present.
Yeah, I think the visitor experience here is quite an interesting one, because we get a range of people. We get people who are really interested in where their food comes from, and they are interested in where we get the grain from and where we sell it to and what we do with it in between the two. We also get people coming just for the historical fix, if you like, of coming into an old building and looking and seeing what it is. And then we often get sort of family groups where it's really interesting to listen to language that the parents use, because it shows that there isn't a full understanding of how food is processed in the modern world. So they know what's going in and they know kind of what's coming out, but they don't necessarily. A number of times that people talk about the flour going in the top, grain goes in the top, but people talk about the wrong things. It's not part of what our understanding of food is. We don't really understand, unless we grow it, where our food comes from, I think. And that's what the mill allows people to do, is to reconnect with that process.
So, yeah, I think that's, you know, kind of brings it together, that sense of an exchange of wisdom, of knowledge, of the old and new coming back together to really start to try to define a new sense of place. We've returned to the Learning Hut and we'd next like to explore together the concept of slowness. What happens when we double down on slowness?
So for me, in my own practice, it means rejecting hyperproductivity, particularly going the long way round. So finding solutions or asking more questions that might lead me to different places and trying to move at a different pace that allows me to observe more actively. You know, this can lead to feeling in my body a bit more and feeling hyper-present maybe.
I agree with what Roy's been saying around taking the long way around, because I think it allows for more creativity. If you're a beginner and you're coming into any project you might be taking part in, you don't want to just be told what to do. You want to try and figure out what to do. A bit of trial and error. You could also lead down a new path that the person who's telling you what to do wouldn't have even thought of. So you're just coming up with new things, and that is much better than sticking to a routine where you won't even learn anything. And doing things slower actually allows you to embrace it and remember it and enjoy it. And if you don't enjoy it, you might not want to do whatever you've done again. If you're enjoying what you've done, you'll come back, you'll do it again. And that's what we want when we're doing any volunteer work. We want them to enjoy it, so they'll do it again.
So it's like nurturing that sense of kind of wanting to return to something and commit to something and allowing that exploration to guide like the developments of whatever will be.
I mean, slowness is, there's a rhythm to what happens at this site. When we are milling, it feels like there's a heartbeat and it's very, very steady because it depends on the mill. Therefore, when we are in the process of producing flour, you do get a feeling of calmness, of it taking its time. You can't rush it. You can put more water through it, but it doesn't actually make a lot of difference to it. You can put more power on, which is what I meant by that. But actually the production and therefore the processes that take place has a pace, and it isn't quick. You know, it's comparatively slow compared to certainly modern equivalents. And the site as a whole, not just the mill, but the wider country park, you know, we have people who come and see they come daily, twice daily, some people, just to take themselves into the natural world, to be able to slow down, to be able to take stock for exercise or just purely for enjoyment. And I think that's a very real part of the site.
So it's almost like we're talking more about the process, again, about this exchange, rather than being fixed on necessarily outcomes or set ideas of what will come next.
I'm also thinking about how when you slow down and you begin to see things differently and you begin to understand their thingness rather than their economic value, beginning to understand alternative ways of living and maybe anti-capitalist or post-capitalist sort of understanding of how we can move beyond this hyper-productivity, how we can move beyond this kind of numbers back towards, commoning and finding a sense of place and forging community around places that are built into the environment.
And it feels almost like it's preparing that ground for allowing things to happen, both in, you know, what happens here on site, but just with people being able to be in nature and to think creatively and think differently about alternative ways of living or being or doing or creative and doing that together.
I think we've spoken a lot about how slowing down can dramatically change the process that we're going through, but it does actually also change the outcome. For example, when I was planting trees with the other young people from Barnsley Youth Council, we did it over several days. If you had done that really quickly, which we could have done it really quickly, get out of the cold because it was February and it was snowing. But the quicker you do it, that could result in less trees actually taken to the ground and less would have actually grown. And that means that all we did was honestly a waste of time, and we've lost a lot of trees as well, because then ones that won't have taken, we can't reuse. So slowing down will actually usually result in a better outcome as well.
Yeah, I can add to that as well. We were talking earlier, Simon, about when we were inside the mill at the beginning, and you were saying about all the processes that you're hoping that can happen in the regeneration of this space. Yeah. And, you know, it's likely that it will take a long time, and it's likely that it will have to be done in very slow, methodical, embodied stages. And I think that's so important when we think about the building as this site of digestion or as this site of breathing. We were talking about how old the building is. You have to take all the layers of paint that have been added over the years in a very short-term thinking, to now take them off and then learn how to lime the walls. And in what we're saying about allowing the walls to breathe, I just think is such a beautiful turn of phrase. It's not something that we really consider when we think about buildings, the idea that they're living and they have sort of bodily functions, if you like. So I think there's something about being inside that mill. The slowness is enforced, if you like.
It is very much the heartbeat of the site. And I think, you know, the idea that it breathes, I mean, it's a grade two star listed building, we've got to look after it, etc. But actually, the reason it's been here nearly 400 years is because it's been allowed to evolve and be, you know, and to live, in inverted commas. And I think all too often our current construction practices are around speed, and it's about, and short-termism. It's about creating a box, almost hermetically sealed, that you can live in safely, where actually sometimes different routes would be better. And I think it'd be interesting to see 400 years time how many houses are still standing compared to the mill.
So for our next question, what is the ecological impact of intentional resourcefulness? So with this question, we're thinking about perhaps having a focus on materials, what is perceived as waste, expanding lifestyles, closing of the loops, byproducts, second life, half life. Also thinking about how we could connect with other organisations or individuals to prevent unnecessary landfill. Or finding ways to creatively recover non-human and planetary health by perhaps using less toxic materials or working with seasonal abundances. Learning to break things down for digestion. Going slow.
Clearly, resourcefulness is important, and on any project you need to be thinking about this. And I think it easily links to the previous question about slowness. If you're going to take your time and actually look at the whole length of the project, how you're starting the planning process, how you're going to maintain whatever you've finished during the action, and how you're going to keep that going. And for generations, you're thinking long term, not short term. And that is where intentional resourcefulness comes in. You've got to think, what do I need now? What am I going to need? Where can I keep what I'm going to need? You've got to think of all the different branches that are going to come with this. Who can I work with? Where am I going to find these? Are they going to want to work with us? It's absolutely everything you need to think of, and it's really important when it comes to a project and the project actually being successful and staying successful and not just happening once, and being in the community as well. Because all the projects around us, when it's to do with the environment, I always try to get my community involved that's near me, because if they're involved, it's going to stay, and because they're the people who are going to keep it going. So intentional resourcefulness is very important, and I think it needs to be thought about more, because I do think people rush into something and they don't think, where's this coming from? They just jump straight away and do the part that looks the most effective, when in reality, it's not actually like that.
And it's almost like it's promoting that sense of collective action and ownership and responsibility.
I feel like you're talking about the infrastructure, and I feel like that's a really important term in terms of like that umbrella of where do things come from, like the material life cycle. So what happens before we get to the bit that everyone sees or eats? Where do the materials come from? What's the labour that's involved in it? What are the byproducts, the waste products? And what happens after everyone's seen or eaten or whatever? And expanding our own horizons and looking at the wider life cycles of materials can hopefully help us understand like how to decommodify our relationship with things like flour. So going into the mill and seeing where the flour has come from, seeing the processes that it has to go through in order to become the thing that we buy, and also finding out where what happens to the waste materials or whatever it is. So for me, that's really important. In my practice, I think that's always the first set of questions that I ask myself with any project that I take on.
The mill itself is quite an interesting example of it, because although it is a heritage site, it's a cultural site, at the heart of it is a business. You know, the flour business is there to generate an income. And therefore, what we try to do, what I've tried to do, is to minimise our waste, is to reduce what isn't used at all by anybody. So we have a number of byproducts that come. Most people want to buy white flour. It's the way it is. It's unfortunate because it means that we effectively have 25 to 30% of the grain that we mill becomes a byproduct. And they're predominantly two products, bran and a semolina. And so what we've tried to work out is how can we, rather than just shoving it in landfill, how can we find a route for it to be utilised? And soon after I started, we applied for and got an animal feed licence. So it means that any of our byproducts, we can then look to move on to somewhere else to be utilised. As a mill, one of the sort of holding principles, if you like, we only use UK-grown organic grain. So we immediately limit what we can get. But also it means that we have to be very careful about how we use it. We can't just waste it. And that goes throughout the entire flour business. And as a wider site, we're trying to look at how we can do things more environmentally friendly, and more sustainable, and looking at our resourcefulness. So, for instance, we are looking at how we can use what is on site to help overcome our energy issue. We have a limited electrical supply on site. So we're looking at, you know, what are the feasible options, in terms of renewable generation of electricity. So we might look at a hydro scheme using the overflow from the mill pond. We might look at ground source heat pumps. We might look at how we can use, we've looked at, and it's very expensive, how we use the water from the reservoir, you know, which in itself is another living system going, linking back.
All of the materials that you talked about that could be seen as waste, it could be argued that they're not waste at all and that they have a secondary value. It's just about finding where the who values those. And that is a way of building your community or building your business more horizontally. So not seeing them as lesser materials, but just seeing them as something that's not usable here, but maybe usable elsewhere. When I came and met you this morning, I asked you, could I have some bran? Because I'm going to make some bokashi, which is a inoculating bran with microbial life to help compost. So, you know, there's in my practice, there's no waste materials.
From my perspective, like leading with this intentional resourcefulness is making us really break down and think about each part of the process and about the value of each thing, and trying to encourage more of a thought around building an ecology where everyone's sharing and exchanging and things have different definitions. Yeah, so it's kind of breaking a lot of these kind of ideas down or feelings about what is waste, what is not waste, how everything has a value, how everything can be part of a change or a new way forward.
So there's been a number of projects on site over the last few years, one of which was focusing on the wetland areas of our woodland. And subsequent to that, they started looking at developing our reed bed, which had been decreasing over time with just the way that the water levels had changed. And so we've been working with some local specialists in trying to increase our reed beds at the far end of the reservoir. And that work has continued this year with our current volunteering project, Volunteer Futures. They've been reinstating and enlarging the reed bed. And part of the benefit of it is that we get quite a lot of old mine water runoff at the top end of the site coming through, and the reed beds filter it out. So they filter out all the nasty stuff that's still coming through them. It's not horribly nasty, it's not toxic. It's just not pleasant for the environment as nice clean water is. And the reeds actually you know, sort of filter out the stuff we don't want in the reservoir.
Narva Reservoir, July 9. Be still and see what happens when you stop trying to control everything in your life. I'm privy to many languages overlapping from birds, insects, plants that I have not met yet. And four old guys fishing and tutting and smoking who don't mind me watching over their shoulders in silence. Find the moment of nothing. It seems like nothing, but it's actually everything. Without the noise of your guilt of the past or worry for the future, which still might not happen yet. Here we can be forever in now.
Thank you for listening. Changing Currents, Climate Conversations in South Yorkshire is a Radio Arts Catalyst production. The series producer is Kitty Turner, with sound design by Ashley Holmes. Arts Catalyst is a visual arts organisation based in Sheffield, South Yorkshire. We develop creative projects connected to the world around us. If you'd like to find out more about our work, please visit our website at www.artscatalyst.org. A special thank you to all those who took part in creating this series. The series was made possible through funding from the South Yorkshire Mayoral Combined Authority. The Mayor, MCA and LEP have a shared purpose to create a stronger, greener, fairer South Yorkshire, to work together to unlock the potential of South Yorkshire people, businesses and places and ensure they prosper. Radio Arts Catalyst is supported by Arts Council England.